A science story.
Is NYU scientist the...
I felt right. I figured it out.
It was that golden moment.
Because science was on my side.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Story Collider, where we bring you true personal stories about science. I'm your host, Aaron Barker, and this week we're presenting stories about research and the surprises and challenges that we encounter in the midst of it. Our first story today is from Eric Vance. It was recorded in August 2018 at Beer Baron Tavern in Washington, D.C. The theme that night was insight.
Okay, so my first like assignment research, like freelance story, was kind of shitty. And I don't mean like I did a bad job or that it wasn't a very good topic. Like there was literally a lot of fecal matter in the story. And let me tell you about it. So after like months and months of trying to convince an editor to give me a story, I finally got a major magazine to offer me a story in that would send me out to do the reporting. And I was so excited, but I was also really, really nervous. The story was about a guy named Jacek Kozieł who studies volatile components of complex fermentation matrices. In other words, he smells pig shit for a living. And I was really excited because this was going to take me to Ames, Iowa. And everyone loves Ames, Iowa. And this is the first time that I was going to go into a place and try to get the story and then come out of like 3 days. And I was really nervous because, you know, I didn't know if I could just go in and get the story. Like, how do you even do that? And I was especially excited because I had just proposed to my girlfriend who had really supported me emotionally and financially through this whole process of going after this dream of becoming a science writer. And now it was going to happen. So I book a flight to Omaha, Nebraska, and I fly out there. And it was only really when I landed that I learned that Nebraska and Iowa are actually two different states. So I rented a car and drove to Iowa. And as soon as I got out in Iowa, I smelled this chemical. It's actually a phenol. And this is it's a low vapor pressure chemical that basically sticks to anything it touches. And it's often called barnyard or even Band-Aid. And basically, it sticks to like dust, and then it floats for miles. And it's the first thing you smell when you come to a farm. It's this sort of sweet smell. And that's basically what Jacek Kozieł studies. Like, that's his jam, is these chemicals that he can sort of break out and figure out what's in them. And he's really good at it. Like, he has this amazing nose. He could have been designing perfumes for Christian Dior or like one of the best vintners in the country. I mean, he has this, he can smell these really complex chemicals, but I mean, he doesn't make perfumes and he's not a vintner. I mean, he smells pig shit. And how good is he? He's so good that when you fart, he can tell you what you ate. That's how good he is. And so we met, and he like brings me into his lab, and he has the most amazing lab I've ever seen. It's this incredible place. It's like all based around smell. So all of the markers are, of course, little smelly markers, and the students can like practice and see if they can like figure out what smell it is, which is actually kind of hard if you've ever tried to do it. It's like grape, maybe? Lime? I don't know. And then he's got these like fume hoods, like in a normal lab, but these have these like a little tube coming out of them, and they're emitting this smell that smells like farts. Because he's trying to reverse engineer farts. Because why not? It's awesome. And like, it's just this wonderful, you know, all these little surprises around every corner. My favorite was this one little cabinet that you basically open up, and inside is all of the worst smelling things that he has ever isolated. I don't know if you guys know this, but like in Atlanta, like the CDC has this vault of like all the worst like viruses and diseases on Earth and stuff like that. Right? This is like that, except for what? Like stank? I mean, this is like the Fort Knox of, I guess, ass. Like it's the worst thing you can ever imagine. I'm saying that this is an undergraduate campus. This is an unlocked cabinet. Like, how is this even still here? You know, I think of 30 things off the, like, right off my head. There's like, oh, that'd be great. You know, so many great pranks. And in the back of this little cabinet, there's one little bottle, and all these bottles are sort of sealed, but one of them is a sealed bottle inside another sealed bottle, inside another sealed bottle. And I was like, oh my God, what is that one? And I go to, of course, I go to reach out and grab it, and he's like, you know what? Don't even touch that one. I was like, oh my gosh, what is this? And he's, it's ladybug taint. See, some of you guys are thinking the same thing I was, right? When you think of ladybug taint, you're thinking, you know, the only thing taint I know of is, you know, area between the genitals and the asshole. It's the taint, you know? I didn't know ladybugs had that. And I was like, that's really cool. But he says, no, that's not what ladybug taint is. Turns out that ladybugs, anytime you see an animal that's red and black, it's a signal, don't eat me, I will mess you up. And in the case of ladybugs, it's this one chemical that basically is so strong, if you took a teaspoon of it and put it in an Olympic-sized swimming pool, you'd still be able to taste it. That's how strong it is. It's brutal. And, when this chemical gets into a grape crush, it tastes like if one ladybug gets in the grape crush, it tastes like a little bit like bell pepper. But if like two or three get in there, it's ruined or tainted. So ladybug taint, right? Really interesting. And so then he takes me to the pride and joy of his lab. Now this is the machine that basically allowed him to, you know, find ladybug taint and everything else that he's done in his laboratory. And it's called a multidimensional gas chromatography mass spectroscopy olfactometer. I mean, we've all seen it, right? You got two of them in your basement right now. This is this amazing device. It basically takes a chemical, breaks it up into pieces, then puts it down one of two little tubes. One goes into a mass spec, which tells you what's in it, and the other one goes to a little cup over your nose. And so you can sort of like, you know, smell every little piece. And what's interesting about this is that when it comes to smell, we don't really have a lot of words to describe the smells that are around us. I mean, you think about, like, we got lots of words for shapes and sounds, but how many words do we have for smells? The only one I can come up with is musty. But like everything else is, it smells like something. So there's this whole wheel of different things that he uses, like with smells like taco shell or wet cardboard or mushrooms. And so the first thing he puts in there is wine. He puts like a wine sample in there. And we all have that friend who like drinks wine and goes like, oh, is that summer squash? I'm getting a little bit of aged wet leather. Are you getting that? And they're obnoxious, right? We hate that guy. But turns out he's right. All of those chemicals, oh, come on. There's a few of you out there. It turns out that he's right, actually, though. He or she is right. There are these chemicals in the wine that you can actually break up and you can smell them one at a time. And that's what the olfactometer does, is it lets you smell them. And so, but I don't really have the words for that. So what I'm smelling is, is sixth grade camp. My first girlfriend. The house I grew up in. You know, because the part of your brain that processes smells is right next to the part of the brain that processes memory. And so I'm having these great moments. It's wonderful. If you guys ever get a chance to use an olfactometer like this, I highly recommend it. It's amazing. So then he puts in the star of the show, which is pig shit. And he was a little worried that like I wouldn't get all the nuances of the pig shit. So rather than like putting it in for 10 minutes the way he normally would over the pig shit, he puts it in overnight. So he can get like the full brunt of his favorite matrix. It's hard to, well, the first few smells actually are kind of like wine. You still get that sort of mushroom and you get a little bit of the, you know, wet cardboard or whatever. Because they're both fermentation processes. One's organized, the other one's not. But I mean, they're kind of the same. And then you get to the business end of pig shit. And if you've never experienced the business end of pig shit, it's the sulfates. And God, how do I describe this? It's a little like having a manure truck drive over you and then back up over you again to see if you're okay, and then drive up over you again and then back again and over again, just sort of over and over. It's a little like if you've ever been on the metro and you see that there's that one person who's like, you can smell him from the other side of the car. Imagine taking his underwear, putting him over your head, and then sticking your head inside one of those campground like toilets and just letting the experience flow over you wave after wave. Like, that's what it's like, just shoving these smells right up into your brain. And the worst thing about the whole thing is, like I said, these things have low vapor pressure. That's why they stick to dust and you can smell them far away. It also sticks to the inside of your nose. So that everything you eat for 3 days or everything you smell tastes like pig shit. And I step out from this thing and I'm a little scarred. And I sit down with Jacek. And the great thing about Jacek is that the whole time I'm there, he can't figure out why I'm writing about him, because he thinks he has the most boring job in the world. And I talk to him for a while, and I get on the plane, and I have a shit-tasting meatloaf and a shit-tasting cocktail to sort of wash it down. And it occurs to me that I've done it. You know, that in order to do this job right, you have to completely immerse yourself in the story. I mean, you have, and I realized that I had like literally gone up to my nose in this story in order to find the narrative that I wanted, and that I could do this, and that this was something that, you know, I'd like reached my goal, and this is my dream. And I get off the plane, and there to meet me is my girlfriend, now wife, who's there to pick me up. And, you know, and I've had this amazing experience. And I walk up to her, and she says, "How was the trip?" And I said, "It was, you know, you smell a little like shit." Thank you.
That was Eric Vance. Eric is an award-winning science journalist based in Baltimore. Before becoming a writer, he was, at turns, a biologist, a rock climbing guide, an environmental consultant, and an environmental educator. He graduated in 2006 from UC Santa Cruz science writing program and became a freelancer as soon as possible. His work focuses on the human element of science, the people who do it, those who benefit from it, and those who do not. He has written for the New York Times, Nature, Scientific American, Harper's, National Geographic, and a number of other local and national outlets. His first book, Suggestible You, is about how the mind and body continually twist and shape our realities. While researching the book, he was poked, prodded, burned, electrocuted, hypnotized, and even cursed by a witch doctor, all in the name of science. And you can hear about many of those experiences in Story Collider Stories, including the one that we have up next, which I'll explain in a moment. Before we move on to the next story, I want to remind everybody that Story Collider is currently holding online storytelling workshops. I believe we still have a couple spots open in our September workshop, If You Act Fast. You can find out more about that and our upcoming shows and slams at storycollider.org. Our next story today is from our executive director, Liz Neely, who we are sadly saying goodbye to on Monday. We wanted to release this story that she told at one of our online shows a few months ago as a send-off. And here's a little added bonus. Eric Vance, our previous storyteller in this episode, is actually a character in the story. Did I just blow your mind? So, here we go. Our next story today is from Liz Neely. It was recorded online in May 2020 in Liz's living room in Washington, D.C. The theme that night was One in a Million.
So, it turns out that the hypnosis lab, it's not really a lab at all. It's an office. It has a comfy chair. And the blinds are drawn, but that's pretty much it. I'm here because my friend Eric is writing a book about pseudoscience and false memories, placebos. And he's been running around having adventures because that's the kind of person he is. He's even managed to get himself cursed by a brujo. And I'm the research assistant, so I'm doing what I'm good at, which is reading papers. I'm digging into the scientific literature to understand, is there any research behind all these incredible claims of how the brain works and how powerful it is? But I've spent at this point like 6 hours at the UW Regional Trauma Center watching Eric go through a series of tests. He's getting experimented on and nothing has happened. I'm bored. And, like, it's important. I should be excited to be here because, you know, I've heard reports about how clinical hypnosis can do incredible things like burn victims who are just screaming in agonizing pain, they get hypnotized and boom, like, no pain, they can scrub their wounds out. But there's no patience here. It's just me watching Eric, and I'm watching him struggle and, you know, fidget and fail. And all I can think is, I could do so much better. Like, strap me in. Measure my brain. Like, I want the electrodes. Like, I want to, like, science me up. But that's not my job. I don't get to participate in this trip. I am just supposed to be observing, recording, and it's boring. So we've been in this hypnosis session for more than half an hour at this point, and Dr. Patterson brings the session to a close, brings Eric out of the hypnotic trance he'd put him into, and kind of just says, like, well, that really, nothing happened. Eric agrees he didn't feel anything. And I'm thinking, well, yeah, I know nothing happened. I have half an hour of the world's most boring videotape that I've been filming this whole time, and my arm hurts. And I'm disappointed, right? Because, like, I'm here to see extraordinary things, I had hoped. And I feel like a deeper sense of disappointment, too. Like, I had worried that this was pseudoscience, that it was bullshit. And maybe it was, right? Like, science doesn't happen if the experiments don't work while you're watching them, right? Mm. So I'm packing up and thinking, like, oh, well, this was a waste of a day. But then Dr. Patterson pauses and he looks at me and goes, well, what if we tried on Liz? And I'm like, I'm so ready. This is my moment. Like, here we go. Finally. So Eric and I swap places. I sit in the comfy chair. Dr. Patterson starts talking to me in his very soothing hypnotic voice. And I'm jazzed because, like, he's a serious researcher. He's a big shot, right? He's faculty both in surgery and psychology. I want to impress him. And I also feel like I'm well equipped to impress him because I'm thinking about the time, like, I was bragging that I can drop my heart rate on demand. And the guy at the bar was like, no, you can't. I was like, yes, I can. And he slapped his iWatch on me. And then I dropped my heart rate on demand and got a gin and tonic out of that. So science. So Dr. Patterson begins by saying that he's going to induce a hypnotic trance in me and that I may not notice anything at all. That I might just, it may feel like nothing at all is happening. And what's important is that I feel relaxed, but he doubts that I will notice anything. But what he would like me to do is to notice if anything changes for me. And I'm thinking, I'm alert. I'm ready to notice. I'm a scientist. Like, this is what I do. I notice things. Let's go. So Dr. Patterson asks me to imagine a staircase. And he says, as I count down the stairs, you'll step down that staircase in your mind and it will be easy. And just notice yourself and how you're feeling. And I'm thinking, yeah, yeah, yeah. I have a sleep app that does exactly this. Like, I've done my homework. Let's go. And so Dr. Patterson starts the count and he says, I'm going to begin. One step down. You're feeling relaxed. Two steps down. Three steps down. Notice that you feel calm and relaxed. That's good. And I'm playing along. I'm like, okay, cool. Waiting for something to happen. I'm very relaxed and I don't want to interfere with this experiment. So I'm not trying to judge it, but I'm like just checking in. Like, are my sensory systems working? Right? I can hear the scratching of Eric's pen on the notebook. So I'm like, cool. Everything's good. And Dr. Patterson leads me deeper, four steps, five steps deeper and deeper. And at this point, he asks me to take my right hand and raise it, just to lift it off the arm of the chair and let it hover an inch in space. And I'm not supposed to do anything with it. I'm not supposed to voluntarily control it, but he asks me to imagine a string connected to my wrist that attaches to a helium balloon. And that my arm will feel perhaps very light as I relax. And I think, I know what's happening. This is this is a tool in hypnosis. It's supposed to, it's a dissociative tool, right? The idea is that both by suggesting to me that my hand's not under my own control, but that some other force is lifting it, that will deepen my own hypnotic trance. But also, it's a cue for the doctor. So he can tell if my hand is lifting that I'm deeper in the trance, right? So I'm sitting there feeling good. And I remember that this thing is called an ideomotor reflex. And I'm like, if I can remember the word ideomotor reflex, clearly I am not hypnotized. So we're fine, right? And so I play along, I notice, and we just keep going down the steps and 6, 7, 8 steps down, 9 steps, 10 steps. It's soothing, it's relaxing, I'm noticing. But I'm also, I don't have a busy little monkey brain. I'm not judging. And I definitely don't want my brain to interrupt the experiment. So I'm just noticing. Dr. Patterson talks to me about, remembering and forgetting. And he says that nothing really matters in this experiment except how relaxed and comfortable I feel. And then, you know, we don't have that much time. We've already been in this experiment for a long time. It's time to turn around and go back up the stairs. And we start doing. So he's counting up now. And he says, 10, 9, 8. You know, there's no rush. There's plenty of time. I'm still noticing. Nothing's happening. 7, 6. And his voice is getting louder. I notice his voice getting louder. And he says that when I awaken from my hypnotic trance, that I will feel alert and refreshed. Sounds nice. And he says that I also might feel surprised, that when I come to, I might feel ready to be surprised. And I'm just thinking I'd be surprised if I'm surprised by anything, because I have been noticing and observing this whole time and I'm very relaxed, but nothing's happened. And then, so he's saying, 4 or 5, Liz, you can put your hand down. And I do. And then there's this pause and he says, Liz, you can put your hand all the way down. And I think, what? Here's my hand. It's hovering just an inch over the arm of the chair, and I put it down. And then all of a sudden, it hits me. My hand is up. It's up here. It's been up here the whole time. What the hell? How did I not notice this? But my eyes are still closed, and I'm not all the way awake yet. And so I force my hand all the way down, but because I think if there's this split second where it feels like I'm going to put my hand through my leg. And I'm thinking, what the hell? And he says, 3, 2, 1, you're awake and you're alert and you're relaxed and happy. And I'm thinking, I'm awake and I'm alert. I am not happy. What just happened? What is this? And he laughs and he congratulates me and he says, congratulations, you are highly suggestible. And this is the word he uses, suggestible. And I'm just like, what? He tells me I'm part of the 10% of the population that is highly suggestible, which means it's really easy to hypnotize me. And I'm backpedaling really quickly because while I was in the trance, I was thinking, hoo-hoo, I have such a powerful brain, I can't be hypnotized. And now I'm thinking, ha-ha, I'm so good at meditation that maybe I'm really easy to hypnotize. And I try and tell him this, this is my hypothesis. And he listens, he's like, well, yeah, that's interesting. This idea that mindfulness and hypnosis might be somehow related, but yeah, that's not, it doesn't work like that at all. And he goes on to tell me that I shouldn't feel bad that we say suggestible, but that sounds like gullible, like it's something you wouldn't want to be. But he says he thinks of it more as like a strength or a skill. And turns out, well, it's really handy to have this particular skill. I can hypnotize myself so I don't feel pain and manage to do things like get an IUD or get all 4 of my wisdom teeth pulled out with no pain medication, no problem, which is awesome. But yeah, it's amazing. But here's the thing. He also tells me that with this remarkable skill I have, that I still should not go to any circuses or stage performances where professional hypnotists are doing stage work. Because get this, he says that they will be able to see me, that they will recognize me in the crowd and that I'm susceptible to them. And I'm like, wait, they can see me? He says something maybe about how much white shows around my eyes when I look up. And I'm just thinking, I can't see them. I can't, like, identify a hypnotist. This is, feels unfair. But really, I think when it all comes down to it, I pride myself on being a science person. I think rigorously. And I had wanted to see something remarkable, something that science struggles to explain. But in terms of, like, being the thing that science struggles to understand, I don't like that as much, for real. But if I ever have the opportunity to go in and get tested, like be a part of experiments again, I am so ready for that. Like, science, this brain of mine, I want to understand. You know, give me all the tests. Because, you know, if you give me a test, I'm pretty sure I'm going to ace it. Thanks.
That was Liz Neely. Liz has been the executive director of Story Collider for 5 years and co-host of our weekly podcast. She says she is not a naturally gifted storyteller, but she came into the field the hard way, reading research papers on narrative and science communication. She started her career as a marine biologist, and her first job was to support community-based projects in Fiji and Papua New Guinea. Learning firsthand that science belongs to everyone changed everything. She misses the ocean these days, but loves getting to think about all different kinds of science now. We're so grateful to Eric and Liz for sharing their stories with us. The Story Collider is also very grateful for the support of Science Sandbox, a Simons Foundation initiative dedicated to engaging everyone with the process of science. The Story Collider is led by me, Artistic Director Aaron Barker, as well as, for the next few days anyway, Executive Director Liz Neely, with help from Deputy Director Nissa Greenberg, Operations Manager Lindsay Cooper, and the rest of our amazing team. The stories featured in today's podcast were from shows produced by Miriam Zaringhollam, Shane Hanlon, Nissa Greenberg, and me, Aaron Barker. The podcast is produced by our podcast team, including Jen Chen and Gwen Hogan. The theme music is by Ghost. Special thanks to Beer Baron and our online platform Crowdcast for hosting these shows, and to Liz for everything she has contributed to Story Collider and taught us over these past 5 years. Thanks for listening.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.